I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Silver Donald Cameron was a prolific writer and in various genres. There were plays and newspaper columns, novels, as well as the nonfiction he was likely best known for. He was also an activist in the best sense of the word, someone who cared about the environment, and that was clear in his work and documentaries, many of which are available and linked to at thegreeninterview.com. Don appeared on this program in 2016 when he and his wife, the writer Marjorie Simmons, traveled throughout the country to promote their respective works. They ended up on the West Coast to spend the winter away from the East. Don's reputation as a writer preceded him, and he was honored by the country he knew so well with the Order of Canada and the Order of Nova Scotia. Silver Donald Cameron died on the 1st of June 2020, just 3 weeks shy of what would have been his 83rd birthday. And as he is being mourned across this country, his final book has just been published. Blood in the Water, a True Story of Revenge in the Maritimes, is cinematic in scope, but it gets to the heart of the Nova Scotian fishing village where in 2013 a small-time criminal named Philip Boudreau disappeared after he was caught vandalizing lobster traps. One of their owners took out a rifle and fired 4 shots and rammed and sank Boudreau's boat, and his body was never found. The book chronicles the lives of those involved, the industry of lobster fishing, and the charm and character of small-town life in the Maritimes. It is a place that is steeped in community and history, and Mr. Cameron does a marvelous job in capturing the spirit of this part of the world, one he knew well, loved, and loved him in return. Marjorie Simmons joins me now to talk about the book, to talk about Don, and to join me in remembering this remarkable man. Ms. Simmons is an award-winning journalist and author of the memoirs Coastal Lives and Year of the Horse. She is a noted teacher of memoir writing and this past spring published Memoir, Conversations in Craft, an outstanding book that looks at how good memoir is written. We'll have Marjorie on in a few weeks to talk about her own book, which is a marvelous book about memoirs and memoirists as they share their wisdom. Visit silverdonaldcameron.ca for more information. As I told Marjorie, I not only admired Don, but I like him very much. This book is published by Viking. Please welcome back to the Plante on the Line program, Marjorie Simmons. Ms. Simmons, good morning.
Yes, hello, and how are you today?
I'm well. How are you?
Well, not too bad. It's a rainy day here in the Maritimes, so it's actually the afternoon, but we're all hunkered down and working inside comfortably.
Indeed. I sent you a note offering you my condolences. I was very sorry to hear of Don's death, and what I want to do other than talk about Blood in the Water is I want to remember Don because I think he should be remembered, right?
Well, absolutely. Number one, thank you very much for your condolences. It was a terrible shock to lose him as quickly as we did, especially when he, oddly enough, was in perfect health until he wasn't.
Uh-huh.
So that was definitely a shock. And very much so, you know, celebrate the man, celebrate the work, celebrate the, you know, the brilliant book that just came out in August, which has been on the bestsellers list ever since.
I admired him a great deal, and for a long time, because I'd read his books over the years, right?
Yes.
His journalism over the years. But when I met him and met you, he was a guy that one instantly liked, and I'm sure that's the case with people he met over the years.
Yeah, Don really enjoyed, I don't know, he enjoyed life, he enjoyed people, he had no sort of, I don't know, airs about him, you know, he's a very down-to-earth man, and he always admired people who could do things, so whether that was write a book or build a house or build a boat, you had his admiration. He loved people who were skilled in many different ways.
One of the things as I was reading Blood in the Water that I don't know why it surprised me, but... well, I think it surprised me because it's of a different coast than I'm familiar with, say. Maritime life is, or maritime culture, I should say, or culture in the Maritimes, is very different, and it's unique. He came from here. He was born in Toronto, but he came from the West Coast. In 1971, when he moved there, was it difficult for him to get adjusted, say, to the culture, to the people, to the mores even of what it's like on the East Coast?
No, actually, when he came here, he always said he knew he was home. He really liked, again, we're talking about down-to-earth people, very generous, people who are really rooted in their communities. He adored that aspect to maritime life that people, you know, here on Isle Madame have been here pretty much since, you know, Shakespearean times. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of years. And of course, the indigenous people that much longer, beyond telling. So he loved the rootedness of the communities here and the generosity. This is not, this region has had periods of great wealth and success. And other times, not so cmuch, you know, with our fishery, the cod fishery, mismanaged by DFO right to near extinction and so on. So, you know, people here know how to get by, they know how to share, they know how to hunker down through the storms. And I think he admired all those qualities very much.
When you moved there, was it an adjustment for you, say?
Well, you see, I'm going to give you a different answer there because I guess I was that much older when I first came to the Maritimes, probably in my late 30s, I guess it was. And I found everything so different that, of course, I wrote my first book about that, and that was called Coastal Lives.
Yeah.
And, I found, you know, just for a short list, the ocean was different. It smelled saltier here. The weather was way different than the coastal temperate zone. The languages were different, the peoples were different, the history was different, the food was different. I could go on and on. I thought it was very funny because I had the impression that, well, one coastal area in Canada can't be that much different than the other. And they are. They truly, truly are. I celebrate the differences on both coasts and, of course, our third coast in the north.
Indeed. That's the thing that, as I was reading this book, that really fascinated me, because I haven't been to that part of the world. But through Don's writing, his just marvelous skill as a writer, you get a sense of what it's like there. And what I want to ask you about that part of the world you think of a character like Philip Boudreau. He could only come from that part of the world, right?
Well, I don't know. I think, you know, in small communities, wherever it might be, in coastal areas where you have a fishery, you may or may not have somebody who is troubled as he was, you know. The fact that he could sort of fly under the radar sometime, I think that can happen in other communities too. But, you know, your original thoughts there on how you got sort of a, information on cultures that you didn't know before. You know, what I knew about Acadians before I came here, you could have put in a teacup.
Yeah.
What I know now is a bit more, and it's like Don, I'm very fascinated by the culture, you know. And he was very much of his culture and of that community. But no, in some ways, I think he's almost a universal figure. You know, he never quite fit in. He had his troubles. The only way he knew how to get by in this world was to, you know, head down and backside low, as they say around here. I won't use the other word they use, but I think you know what it is. And he was very much of his people in some ways. And they didn't want to really turn their back on him. You know, that was part of the complication of this.
Yeah, it's very easy to talk about Boudreau and say, get whatever you know about him, about this case, through, say, media accounts. But then when you read Don's writing, he captures so well the nuance of the story that he's got such grace as a writer that to make the judgment that hey, he's a bad guy or he's done bad things.
But Don would have always been reluctant to sort of place labels on
him. Yeah, yeah.
And as a journalist, he, you know, it was his job to dig and dig deep. He wasn't going to be taking anybody's particular opinion about what Philip, you know, was all about. He really had to dig. But nor was he in a hurry, as I say, to label and to judge. That was about as far away from Don's M.O. as I could ever say to you, you know. But he was really interested, always was, in how people ticked. And another thing that he really, really was fascinated by in terms of small maritime communities was the fact that, you know, if there was conflict or fights or this sort of thing, people had to work them out.
Yeah.
You couldn't, in a city, if you have some sort of, you know, conflict with somebody, well, you can just disappear off their radar. And, you know, with not too much trouble, you can probably not see that person again. I mean, sometimes in small circles, that's a little more difficult. But, you know, here you have to work things out. And Don was absolutely fascinated by that, you know, because, of course, that's the process of hundreds of years of living together and, you know, people coming together to sort out these problems in a much more, I don't know, organic and sensical way. You know, I mean, of course, First Nations have known how to do this since forever.
Yeah.
European cultures, not so much. So Don was, again, really fascinated by that.
What I found fascinating is the just a sense of how important, I don't know how big, and well, I guess in big in terms of revenue, the lobster industry is. We don't have lobster on this coast, so when we have it, it's usually from the East Coast, and it's pricey, obviously, and for reason. Just how big is that industry, What sort of, I mean, for the people involved, I mean, it was their livelihood, right?
Yeah, you know, once upon a time, being a lobster fisherman in a small Acadian community or any other sort of community in the Maritimes, you weren't top man or woman on the pile. You absolutely were not. Fishermen only in recent times have had that kind of, you know, huge success and money, frankly. We've fished our way down the food chain so that there is, still a fairly vibrant lobster fishery. And they're the scavengers of the ocean, you know.
Uh-huh.
We don't have any cod. You know, I could go on and on what we don't have in terms of how we fish down. So, you know, I'd love to say that I was optimistic that the lobster fishery will continue to be vibrant and provide really good livings for a lot of people. Or actually not that many, but a number.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, it will always be a treat. I mean, growing up around here, people were embarrassed to take lobster in their lunches because it was like the poor man's tuna.
Right.
They knew if you went to school with a lobster sandwich, they knew that you were poor because that's what you had on hand and nothing else.
Yeah.
So, I mean, everything's been turned upside down and backwards. But, you know, yes, it is a big, big deal. I mean, planes get filled up with lobster to fly to Paris for New Year's Eve celebrations. So they get it, you know, fresh as can be and all the rest of it. I mean, it's still sort of the diamond of the fishery. But I wouldn't make too many assumptions about how vibrant that fishery is. You know, we're slamming it the way we slammed cod.
Yeah.
And, of course, the way the West Coast has slammed salmon.
Yeah.
You know, and I was a commercial fisheries reporter when I lived on the West Coast. So that will explain some of the heat of my comments.
Right, indeed. Now, so for Boudreau, the purpose of vandalizing the traps, what was that?
Oh, he wanted to make money. He wanted to, but it was more than that. You know, he had kind of a childlike, you know, maturity to him. He liked pissing people off. He liked literally going na-na-na-na-na-na.
Yeah.
You know, it was terribly complex because, you know, some of the people he is stealing from have stolen from others. And it's all kind of, you know, complex and strange. You know, your daughter's getting married, and who do you buy lobsters for the party? You buy them the stolen lobsters from Philip.
Yeah.
I mean, what kind of strangeness is that, you know? This sort of complications, it's for heaven's sake, it's not sort of only happening in one small community, you know, that's not it at all, but it you know, again, I refer to the fact that once upon a time, if your dad was a fisherman, he wasn't exactly, you know, high in the social caste, and now, all of a sudden, you go around Isle Madame, and the biggest homes, and the biggest trucks, and the largest properties all belong to fishermen.
Right.
So, you know, there's jealousies going on. There's, everybody wants to, you know, drive the big truck and have the big house, or most of us, not me. It's hard to explain, and that's why Don dove into those complications so thoroughly.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't just superficial.
Yeah, it wasn't just a, the book is not just about a death or a murder. It's about so much more. He looks at the challenges that law enforcement has. I mean, you know, most of us wouldn't want to take the law in our hands, but I guess in a sense they had to, because the police were precluded in terms. I mean, Boudreau had been in and out of jail what, more than half his life?
Yes. That's about right.
Yeah, and so I mean, you know, it was just hard to get a handle on, and then certainly not someone who could be restored, say, if you will.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the issue of you know, justice, because this was something that Don was absolutely fascinated by, you know, during the course of writing the book. I mean, you have an event, and, you know, you describe that event, and then you describe the people therein to give you a, you know, a deeper understanding of Acadian culture and history in Canada and so on. And then you're thinking, well, you know, okay, so there has to be more here. And, of course, there's a great deal more. The book raises profound questions about the limitations of the justice system itself, about the nature of community, and about our own characters and values. I mean, are you really sure you would not kill if you were pushed beyond your limits?
Mm-hmm.
And these are the sorts of things that Don focused on. It's a sort of a fascinating focus on the limitations of our legal systems. That, and of course, you know, women know this, unfortunately, better than most.
Right.
You know, help me, help me. Well, we can't help you till, you know, you're half dead or dead. You know, he has to hurt you before we can help you. You know, something has, well, what if he's threatened to kill me? Well, I'm sorry, ma'am, we can't help you. These kind of limitations, this is the exact same process we're talking about here with a community that was, you know, being threatened on a, you know, constant basis by this fellow. Sometimes he followed through, sometimes he didn't.
Yeah.
Would you want to be the person with two kids at home when he said, I'm going to burn your house down and your kids in it? Would you want to be the one that said, oh, he's just kidding?
Yeah.
No.
Was Don in the courtroom? I guess he was there from early on, right?
Oh, my gosh. He absolutely loved that part. You know, I mean, there were journalists from across the country, and, of course, local media was out in force. So, you know, it's kind of nice. Journalists often work alone, you know. We're not, don't have those opportunities for getting together, a bunch of us, very often. So, yeah, the courtroom was packed. And again, he's talking to his colleagues from all around the province and across Canada. And, you know, they were fascinated. That was, that's probably one of the more interesting, you know, parts of the research for him.
Yeah.
Less interesting would be going through, you know, hours and hours and hours and hours of transcripts from the court. I mean, the sweat of the brow on this book was something else, you know. You think, again, well, it's a simple story. You know, somebody got killed and somebody went to jail and somebody didn't and so on. Everything about this book was complex. And yet Don wrote it with such energy and in some ways and sometimes affection that I found it an immensely readable book, didn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it reads, I mean, I've read reviews of it, you know, it reads like a novel. One reads it and you can see the characters. You can see the place. I mean, it's awfully cinematic. It had a great sense of how to, and it's his skill as a writer. I mean, he's elegant, he's spare. He takes complex detail about something, and then, you know, even someone like me can follow it, you know?
I'm glad you mentioned his style, because, you know, that's something that's not really talked about very much. We say we like this person's writing or that person's writing, but we don't really talk about style. And Don was a stylist. I mean, he really was, and I love that word you used, cinematic. That was absolutely wonderful. But, you know, he could be spare, or he could be ornate, or he could be incredibly funny. And we don't have, I don't know, we do have stylists, of course, but, you know, they don't come in by the truckload. The really, really fine ones are rare, and it's a joy to read that kind of writing.
Yeah, what was it like to live with a writer who was working on a book like this? I mean, in terms of how you guys worked over the years. Would you see things, or would he pass things around and say, hey, this is what I'm working on, have a look? What do
well,
you,
you know, we talked about our writing each and every day of our lives together, pretty much. And we, you know, we'd have our own projects, and but I'd be as interested in what he was writing as he would be with me, which was wonderful.
Yeah.
I never saw him sweat more on a book. This was really not an easy matter. You have a fairly short story, you know. I mean, person goes out, gets into trouble, gets killed, you know, what goes on. And you've got to make that a gripping story. You can't just, you know, explain what happened and then go, now what? And to tell you the truth, I had to push him fairly hard to do this book. He was extremely reluctant. And he was reluctant because he has lived here so happily since 1971. Among people who he enjoyed and respected and, you know, was very close to in many ways. He had married into the community. His late wife, Lulu Terry O'Cameron, was, of course, born here. And, you know, there was so much that he felt grateful for in terms of coming to this community and being accepted and so on. And he was extremely nervous, on edge, about offending, about getting things wrong in some way. Or just, you know, oversimplifying something that was complex, and he should never worry about that because Don didn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
But he really, I really had to say to him, I said, you know, listen, this is going to be your love letter to Ile Madame. There's nobody on the planet who can do a better job, you know, a more correct job than you will. They will love it. And the response from the community would make me weep. It has been so wonderful. They've said over and over again, he got it. He was so fair, but he's got it.
Yeah. What? So other than your encouragement, how did he get over his hesitation to write about this?
Well, you know, I think any writer, you know, there's nerves you have to deal with any book you're taking on. And the only way to get over it is to go through it. So, you know, day by day, hour by hour, and, you know, let's say a chapter would come together very nicely. I know one day he was talking away and being, you know, just incredibly eloquent about something. He went, la-ti-da, la-ti-da. And I said, oh, my God, there's your lead paragraph. And he looked at me and I looked at him. We just laughed. And it was his lead paragraph. So he put it in there and I said, isn't that a thing of beauty, right?
Yeah.
There's no way of going around something. You just have to go through it and see how it comes together.
The deceptive thing as I'm reading the book is it comes off so effortlessly. But I mean, you've already given us a sense of just how, you know, how much work it is, right? Curious to know what it was like for him to write. I mean, in terms of his habits, did they change over the years?
You know, he came, how do I put this, that book took a fair while to come together, but then you wanted to know what was, you know, how long people had been incarcerated, and you wanted a little bit more than, you know, oh, they went to jail, and that was that. So he did give it a nice round picture, but I don't know, he just worked away on it, and of course, living the lives we do, we never work on one project at one time. And he's a documentary filmmaker.
Yeah.
So during the process of writing the Philip Boudreau book, he is, you know, producing green interviews for his interview site and traveling around the world and collecting these up with his business partner, Chris Beckett, and many, many other things. You know, that's the way a freelance writer's life unfolds.
And when he would write, though, was he a morning person? Was he a night person? What was his day like? So?
He was an everything person.
Really?
Don was really quite happy to work just about every scrap of the day. I like to get up early, so he would get into that pattern for many years. But whereas I would be kind of 6 to 6. He would work in the evening, too. So that was just, you know, he enjoyed it.
Yeah.
That's who he was. And, sometimes I had to, thank goodness we, you know, have dogs, because I would be able to pull him away from his desk saying, the dogs need a walk, you know, so do you.
Yeah. You know, I felt really badly when I realized, when I saw the news that he died. Obviously, I felt sad and awful. But I looked at my email, and he'd written me back in November. He sent me a copy of The Education of Everett Richardson, and I really regret that I never replied, first of all, but I guess he wanted to talk about that, And so I read the book over the summer, and I learned so much about not just the fisheries on the East Coast, but the fisheries on this coast. And it really is just, how old's that book? It's about 40 years old?
Yeah, that was basically what we called a 40th year anniversary edition with the brand new introduction and so on. I adore that book.
It's a marvelous book.
Isn't it something?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, again, the readability is unbelievable all the while you're, learning like crazy about, both coast fisheries. And he saw, huge parallels between the two books that he had produced, so I'm really, really glad to hear you enjoyed that. It's done well, and he loved the fact that he had the anniversary edition coming out at the pretty much the same time as the Philip Boudreau book.
Yeah.
So that's nice to hear you enjoyed that.
And so, for people listening to us who will pick up Blood in the Water, but will want to go back and read some of the other things, that book, the Education of Everett Richardson, that is something that people should read, right? I mean, you don't have to be from the West Coast or the East Coast. It really is a great Canadian book, right?
Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it. I mean, it's Canadian history as only Don can write it and present it in such a lively, again, sometimes amusing and incredibly real way. Yeah, that book is available, from our online bookstore or, directly contacting me. We've got lots of copies of that on hand. There's, a number of his other books that are getting pretty scarce. His Living Beach, the first edition of that. I'm handling that part of the business now of putting out the books and so on. When I get too low on a certain title that I absolutely adore, I go, that's it, done. There are no more Dragon Ladies, his only non-fiction for adults.
Uh-huh.
I have about 3 copies here in the house, and that's it. So if you find one in a antiquarian bookstore or used bookstore, I'd say grab it. I do have lots of Everett Richardson's, and of course, Blood in the Water is available at bookstores everywhere.
Yeah, and for people in this part of the world, I've seen it in the big chain here in Vancouver. So that's readily available, obviously. I wanted to buy Conversations with Canadian Novelists, because I just wanted to read these interviews that he did over the years with these great Canadian writers. I've spent the summer reading them, and it's not, I've never read, say, Rudy Weeb or Jack Ludwig, but I enjoyed getting to know them through these conversations that Don had with them. He had a great reverence for not just novelists, but writers of all stripe in this country, didn't he?
Well, absolutely, and when Don started out being a writer in Canada, being a serious full-time writer in Canada, there weren't a whole bunch of them.
I mean,
you think of the original crew that started up the Writers Union of Canada, and that would be Farley and Claire Mowat, and that would be Don, and that would be Margaret Atwood, Don's early colleagues there just simply wasn't a huge number. They all knew each other, and they were true friends. They wanted the best for one another because being a writer, Margaret Lawrence, Don knew her very well. Lived near to her just outside of London when he was doing his doctorate at the University of London. Had huge respect and affection for her. But, all these people knew each other and supported each other. It's never, ever been an easy road to choose to be a writer in Canada. But at least in the early times, it was sort of like, big writers' club. I mean, you all knew each other, and it just would have been different.
Yeah. You very kindly sent me The Living Beach, and I haven't unfortunately started it yet because I just love Seasons in the Rain.
Good.
I'll talk about The Living Beach in just a sec, but I want to mention Seasons in the Rain because it's a British Columbia that the people that he talks about in the book are generally overlooked nowadays. Because, they're figures of history, a lot of them. But it captures BC so well. And you know, I think it's one of the great books about this province that I'm surprised. First of all, I didn't read it until I got it this past summer. But I'm surprised people aren't talking about it. And I think that's the shame about this all, that he's not as talked about in this part of the world as he should be.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's no doubt that Don has a national reputation.
Yeah.
He chose to live and work in a region that there aren't many full-time writers in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. And he was actually extremely proud of the fact that he was one of the few, possibly the only full-time writer living here, making a living. You know, I mean, Farley Moll would come and go and so on, and we pretty much stayed put. And certainly he did well many, many years before I came along. I wouldn't go too far down that road that Don's not well known in BC. You know, again, you have the early writers who are still there, the Andrea Schroeders and many, many different writers yeah. out there, God knows, who would regard him as a friend and colleague and know how wonderful a book like Seasons in the Rain is. I mean, I adore that book, too, you know. I mean, Don did love the West Coast, not as
yeah.
much as this girl did. You know, he really lost his heart to Atlantic Canada, and there was just no giving it back. But that said, you know, he grew up there, and he was, I think, his early 20s before came first to Halifax and then on to, again, the UK, as I said, to do his doctorate. But, you know, well and truly an adult by the time he left BC. And what I find amusing when we used to go out there, you know, and I'd say, oh, there's this little shortcut here. I'll just show you this. He'd go, oh, well, here's a little faster one right here, you know. And so we do the, you know, I know this city better than you do kind of thing. And damn it if he didn't, you know,
yeah.
because he'd have that just, oh, that unbelievable brain. That can sort of look down from things and go, well, yes, that connects here and that goes there, and this is a much faster route. So anyway, I stopped playing that game after a while, as you can imagine. But Don has a huge reputation among in the writing community. And, you know, unlike earlier times, there is now just a shocking amount of Canadian talent in terms
yeah.
of writing in every genre. You know, it's a big tribe now. It's a big, successful tribe, and the same things that were difficult for a small tribe are difficult for a larger one. The artist's life, the creator's life, is never going to be an easy one, at least not in a country that doesn't value creators the way some
yeah.
countries might,
mm-hmm.
you know. I would say any opportunity you have to read Don's work, do it.
Yeah.
It'll take you on a journey like no other.
For people listening to us who want to understand BC, for example, Seasons in the Rain, I mean, the subtitle is An Expatriate's Notes on British Columbia. I mean, he understands BC so well and the people. I mean, there are a lot of people my age, my generation, who don't know who Hubert Evans is or George Woodcock
yeah.
even. And it's a marvelous way to get to know these people and see the BC that they inhabited, that they influenced in some areas, and get a sense of the history of the province. Because I think, you know, you miss the forest for the trees if you think that... today is it, you know what I mean?
Yes, yes. No, it's really nice to hear you say that because, you know, we have a Hubert Evans Award, of course.
Right.
But it comes to a point where people go, you know, well, who is Dan Smith anyway? He's been, you know,
yeah.
gone for some years now, and here's this award that's in his name, and who was he? And to be reminded, you know, and again, you would have gotten that in Education of Everett Richardson,
yep.
of, you know, the early Union, you know, warriors,
mm-hmm.
right? And BC had them, and we still have them here, you know, but not quite as, I don't know, larger than life as they seem to be in years gone by, you know. But yeah, we should know the people who helped form the places that we live in.
So, as I said, you were very kind to send me a copy of The Living Beach. I'm going to start it just before the holidays. What you said in your note that it was Don's favorite book. What about it? What am I expecting in terms of a read here?
Well, I think it's a glorious book. It was his favorite. I mean, I think that might have a lot to do with the writing experience, where the Blood in the Water was a very demanding writing experience. The Living Beach was much more, easy on heart and soul. He was traveling with his filmmaker friend Charlie Doucette with that one when they were doing some of the research, and Charlie was taking footage, of course, of living beaches. One thing I'll say is you will never look at the beach in the same way. It does live. It actually, don't be sort of like worried about that. It sounds a little spooky. But no, I mean, they have lives, and they have very interesting and complex lives. And he adored writing that book. It was just a really wonderful experience, and I enjoyed the interviews he did for it. You know, there was nothing fraught about it other than the fact that, you know, of course, we're not looking after our world the way we should. But he wasn't so much focusing on that for that book. Of course, in so many of the interviews he did for The Green Interview, he was very much focused on our degradation of the world. But no, this is just a joyous writing about the beach and all its magic.
I can't wait to start it. I mean, I'm as soon as I get off the phone with you, I'm going to start it today. you mentioned his environmentalism, and I think that was a huge part of how he was known across the country.
Thank you for bringing that up. Absolutely. I mean, you know, some of maybe his younger friends would have thought that was a recent focus.
Right.
He was actually out on the seal hunt taking photographs, I guess it would have been, in 1967, I believe it was. I've been, of course, working on his archive here, and I was, sort of shocked and delighted to find these early slides, I guess they were, of the seal hunt. Now, delighted because I'm talking about Canadian history not so much that I'm delighted with the hunt, which, you know, of course, there are many different opinions on, but I'm on the side of the seals. There probably was hardly a time as an adult that he wasn't thinking about the issues that are about the natural world and how we want to live lightly on the world, you know. As an environmentalist in his later years, I mean, I think he, like David Suzuki, he had a heck of a time keeping his spirits up, but of course, that is, in a way, your number one job as an environmentalist, because if you get down, how are you ever going to effect change with the younger ones, you know? And Don did a TED talk that I would definitely recommend people look up online about what can one person do. And again, this is about the environmental crusades, you can say. And if you, most of us have really felt, well, I can't do anything. You know, who am I against Nestle? Who am I against all these corporations that, you know, are really soulless and will take the last goddamn tree on the planet if it means another dollar in the bank? I mean, there's no soul going on, you know. And so Don thought about that and thought, you know, to keep my own spirits up and to sort of, you know, address the younger ones too. I'm going to do this TED talk on what can one person do, and I think we included it in his online celebration of life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I mean, as you can imagine, his loss has turned my life upside down. I had a perfect life that I wanted to keep on, and it's changed now. But you know, even me watching the online celebration and watching the TED talk, I was sitting there smiling because he looked absolutely so vital and so, you know, connected to his subject and so on. And I just felt so incredibly proud of him, you know. So I would totally recommend that you go on YouTube and look up that TED Talk.
I saw that a couple years ago. And I'm reminded of it as you're describing it now. How incredibly hopeful he is, and you know, and you can't help but take that yourself. You know what I mean, and feel that yourself. That it is. I mean, sure, it's dire, but it can't be.
Well, he was absolutely, you know, the glass is half full sort of fellow. I can sometimes be a little bit more, you know, half empty. and he would just shake his head and he'd go, no, there's so much we could do. You know, I mean, thank goodness we weren't both one way or the other. We balanced each other out sometimes, but in different areas. But, he was an optimist and... you know, in everything he took on, he sort of did the work of 10, you know. I mean, he did 20 books. That's no small number of books when you have, when you've done many, many other forms of, he's corporate writing. He wrote plays. He tried it all, you know, and he did it all well. And I don't think he ever thought there were enough hours in the day to create.
The loss of him, I mean, like so many other people, I've been feeling it so acutely, but I can't imagine what it's been like for you.
Well, you know, you're supposed to say that, you know, you're getting on with things and so on. The thing I say nowadays is, you know, I'm going along. That means one foot going in front of the other. That means that I am working. I'm actually working very, very hard because, you know, he's not here and I have a lot more responsibility now for a lot more things. But, you know, I was the luckiest person in the world to find him. And we had 24 years together and 22 of those married. We laughed, you know. We laughed, I swear, every day. Thought I was the funniest person in the world, which of course is a very attractive thing. I loved everything about him. He was such a knowledgeable man, and I'm always thirsty for knowledge. So, you know, I loved the fact that he would came from a generation that would many people memorized glorious poems and sonnets or whatever it might be. You know, and you know, so he could chime in with Shakespeare or with Tennyson or with Pound or whoever it might be, you know, that I would request sometimes as a joke. He just loved learning, and he loved people who, again, as I started out at top of the hour saying, loved people who did things well, and that could be really anything in his books. He was sort of very egalitarian that way. My life is completely different, every one of us is always sort of recreating ourselves at different periods in our lives. You know, sometimes things are quite straight ahead and sometimes they're not. And this is a period for everyone where, you know, I can't teach. God I can write because that feels like normal life. I can get up and write. I had a big year for teaching coming up. Well, that's all gone. And, this is the same as everybody else, you know. And,
sure.
And every time you think, oh, well, I can do that. And then you go, well, no, actually, you can't. COVID has changed our lives and continues to do so. And the part where I get really worried is I don't know how long that's going to go on.
Yeah.
But, you have to have gratitude for the time you've had with a person. I hear his voice every day. If I really, really want to hear his voice, then I go to one of his books. It is hard, though.
It is such a gift to think that years from now, generations from now, they can go to his books. I mean, that's a tremendous legacy. And hear his voice and hear what he's thinking and say, fine, a way to navigate whatever problem that'll be years from now.
Yes, you know, and it's funny because Don Tart was so much in the Green Interviews, which he worked on for 10 years, you know. So not only can you hear, you know, the voice through the writing, we do have an archive of over 100 green interviews, and where that archive will be, where it will find a final home, is one of my preoccupations at the moment. But we're hoping, you know, when you say the word archive, people think, oh, well, you know, you put it away and the dust collects on it and that's that. We so do not want that.
Yeah.
We want those interviews with, you know, Jane Goodall and Farley Mowat and Vandana Shiva and Alexander Morton and on and on and on. I mean, these are people from around the world who are doing things, who are making a difference in this poor, troubled world of ours, you know. I mean, they really are showing what one person can do. We've got the young ones. We've got the older ones. We've got the, you know, the warriors on the ground. I mean, Don and Chris were bouncing down, you know, Peruvian roads, you know, and they went to Bhutan. They went, you know, all over the place, getting these incredible stories. You know, I mean, sometimes I didn't even want to hear about it because I was, I was worried.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, dear, have a lovely time. You know, so he was very, very preoccupied with his filmmaking in the last 10 years of his life, you know. So the books are a huge source of wisdom and enjoyment, and those films are too. I really, really hope that they're going to be, well, we will make sure they are in a place where they are used and enjoyed and added to, you know.
Right.
Supposed to be a finite collection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing some of the clips when I first met you both 4 years ago now, and I just thought, man, these are just such a marvelous resource. But again, it's not just him. Sorry, it's not just whoever he's talking to. It's also him, and so the alchemy of a conversation. I mean, I read that in these interviews with the Canadian novel, the great Canadian novelist. It's so delightful to, you know what I mean, to see their interaction and see whatever he's saying as well, and how much that adds to one's understanding of whatever it is they're talking about.
Well, yeah, I mean, there is a real art to interviewing. And that was an art that he did very, very well. So, you know, in some ways, and I'll tell you right now that I'm enjoying my time speaking with you so much, in some ways a person is only as good as the person who's interviewing them. So, you know, I've recently been talking with a number of people about Don's book and my own books and all sorts of things. And sometimes when people ask you four questions in one sentence, you think, well, which one am I supposed to answer? And do your best, but you know, a good interviewer understands that it's, you know, it's a back and forth, it's a tennis game. So, you know, I try to finish on a note where you know I've finished, and you don't give me four questions at once, you give me one.
And speaking of good interviews, I read your book, Memoir, Conversations in Craft. You were very kind enough to send me a copy of that in the early spring. Again, when you talk to people, as you do in the book, I mean, just delightful to see. I mean, you're obviously interested in how these people write, as a writer yourself. I mean, it adds so much to the conversation that you do draw these people out so well. And so I can't wait in a few weeks, but we're going to spend some time to talk about that book, because I think it's also a very important book.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted you enjoyed it, and I won't, you know, go on about it if we're going to talk about it again, which is so nice. But I had a ball writing that book.
Yeah.
I mean, these were, you know, people who I think the world of in terms of, you know, their writing. And you know, I will say briefly that, maybe I'll, you know, next time say who it was, but one of the interviews that when I showed them their interview, you know, before it was to go to print, said, oh my goodness, I was in an open mood that day, wasn't I? And I said, well, just what you said to me, so I just put it in there.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, yeah, writers sometimes aren't aware of how, I don't know, to the bone they're being, you know?
Yeah. It really is a marvelous book, because, I mean, you talk to some authors who I've read over the years, and to get the insight about a particular book that I liked or didn't like, even sometimes. It could be years ago that I read that book, and get such an insight into what that book was about. I mean, it really is. We'll talk about it in a few weeks, because I want to spend some time seeing how you write as well, because I think that that's important as a reader, especially. It makes the experience all the more richer, right?
Yes, yes. Well, thank you. The memoir book, of course, came out during the start of COVID.
Yeah.
God bless it. It's done very well, and that was a real joy for me to do. So I look forward to talking to you about that another time.
Indeed. I want to wrap up about Dawn's book, Blood in the Water, because I think, it's something that people should read. I mean, I read one review where, you know, that they say it's a marvelous capstone to a career. I don't know. Did he know what this book would mean? I mean, I remember the email he sent me in November. He was very excited about the book, and you could tell that he I think he knew that it was a good book, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, writers are funny creatures. I suppose we're like most others, that we can be a bit superstitious about these things, so you don't really want to start assuming that it will, you know, a book will go one way or another. I never doubted it. I never doubted it. So when I saw that, you know, the inscription, you know, for Marjorie, who always believed, that was nice to see. I didn't know he had written that. But I never doubted it. I think sometimes he was almost like Marjorie, pipe down, you know, it'll be what it'll be. And I said, no, honey, you don't understand. You're going to be on the bestseller list. This is going to be amazing. And, you know, how many men 82 years old can say that they're going to be on the bestseller's list, right?
Yeah,
and he's like, oh, we'll see. You know, I mean, there, you know, refer to the superstition again. But, you know, was he pleased with what he had produced? Was he pleased with his publisher? Was he pleased with, you know, all the circumstances? You bet. Yeah, no, he was certainly feeling very optimistic about everything. But, yeah, writers don't like to get too ahead of themselves.
Yeah. It is a marvelous achievement for him, and I'm just so pleased that we've had this time to talk about him and to talk about this book, because I read somewhere in one of the trades that the rights for it have already gone to a production company. Is that correct?
We had sold rights to the UK and to Steerforth Press in the US, which is in New Hampshire, I believe. So very, very pleased about that. And yes, as of, I guess, 2 weeks ago, we have concluded an agreement with people for the television rights. And this is the same company who did Trailer Park Boys.
Right.
The same producers and actors. And I am over the moon happy. You know, when I am making decisions for Dawn now, you can imagine that I make them very, very, very carefully and with every bit of knowledge I have about him, you know, foremost in my mind, so I make the right decision. And it was instantly clear to me that these people would do an incredible job. You know, now any movie or any television series, there's many a slip, twitch, cup, and lip. I certainly hope that production goes ahead. They are absolutely, you know, pumped about doing the story and on all the rest of it. But they, you know, these are people from here.
Yeah.
They understand poverty. They understand complexity. They understand, you know, the fact that Philip Boudreau was a really challenged fellow. He probably was bipolar. He certainly grew up in terrible poverty.
Uh-huh.
There was a lot going on for that fellow, you know. Don really wanted to make sure he had a fair shake in how he portrayed him. He wasn't just a bad fellow that, you know, woke up one day and started doing bad things. You know, he was troubled from the get-go, and he never got the, help he should have had, you know. So am I excited about, you know, a possible television series with these particular people? Oh, my goodness, yes.
Because the I mean, the story itself, I mean, you know, we know the facts, but I mean, the material that they will have to work with in terms of Don's writing, I mean, as I said earlier, I mean, it's just cinematic in scope. And he had a marvelous eye for the characters and for, you know, situations and, you know, even moments in the courtroom.
Absolutely. And the other thing I'd say before I forget, mm-hmm. Is that, you know, there's bits that are very, very funny.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Unfortunately, you really can't have tragedy without comedy, because comedy's in there.
Yeah.
And that's why comedians are so brilliant at what they do, because they know how to find the comedy in the darkest corners. And so, yeah, that, and again, with somebody like Trailer Park Boys, they're going to know where to find that humor. And, I've had meetings with them now, and, boy, you know, they're serious about getting this right, and I know they will.
Yeah.
And, you know, Gabe asked me a lot of questions about, you know, how did Don see this? And, you know, and again, you know, the pressure on me is sometimes considerable, because I don't want to say the wrong thing. I don't want to misremember. I don't want to. But, you know, so far, so good. You know, Don and I were very, very close. You know, we had years before he was ill that I said, you know, how are we going to manage? We live so much inside one another's minds. So when one of us has to say goodbye to the other, I don't know how we'll manage. And we agreed on that. But that's unfortunately the way it goes. So, I'm excited about the future of Blood on the Water. The most common comment I've had about it was, couldn't put it down.
Yeah.
Read till three. Loved it.
Yeah.
He was so fair. So when you get a nonfiction book that's being read like a novel, you know the author's done it right.
Yeah, I read the book a couple of weeks ago, but the other night I was on Facebook, and he sent a note saying that I should get to bed because I guess it's early where you are and it's really late where I am. And I'd gone back to read something that I'd forgotten and ended up, reading 5-10 pages beyond that because, of, you know, it's just it's a captivating book.
Well, I'm so, so glad, and I'm particularly pleased that you recently read the Everett Richardson book as well, because that's going to give you an even richer experience of Blood on the Water.
Yeah. I mean, it makes me want to go there, I mean, whenever that'll be, right? You know?
Well, you know, as Don once said to me, you know, come on down, our door's always open.
Indeed.
You will find an incredibly hospitable, fun, open-hearted people here. And we're just coming into Celtic Colors, which is an international music festival that takes place each year. And this year it's going to be online, but, you know, ordinarily it's in communities around Cape Breton Island. So, we're still enjoying life here. It's a little bit more quietly than usual.
Uh-huh, indeed. Marjorie, I look forward to talking to you shortly. But I so appreciate this time that you've spent with me now, because it's a marvelous tribute to this book, to Don himself, and I think to you, because you've given us a chance to remember him the way I think we all should.
Thank you. I'm so appreciative for this opportunity to talk about Donna, to talk about the book, and you know, I know it's we all wish we still had him, but think of Don being in this community, loving this community, loving life, you know, very much so. He was just positive about everything. So finish on that good note, and slanchava, which means cheers to you.
The website for more is at silverdonaldcameron.ca. The book is called Blood in the Water, A True Story of Revenge in the Maritimes. It is published by Viking. It is written by the late Silver Donald Cameron. His wife, Marjorie Simmons, joined me on the line from Halifax, Nova Scotia, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.